Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on January 16th, 2015, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Hail Jacques Ibert for the great music. Hail Orson Welles. Hail Shakespeare and hail Chris.
You know, I don't think I really think tonight I enjoyed it more than I ever have.
Isn't that great? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful movie, and I can tell the audience loved it. And you were very sophisticated in your dialogue delivery. You did a wonderful job.
I didn't understand. I mean, I just was like a little parrot, you know. I just said all the lines. I didn't really know what I was saying. I was just a kid. You know?
Well, you were terrific, and Chris indicated she'd like to just take questions, and anything you want to ask her, we're game for it. And I think there's a mic floating around, right? Yeah. So hold your hand up, and the mic guy will come around. And
okay, like this?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Anything I can't answer, I'm going to turn over to Joe, okay?
I'm actually really interested in what Welles was like in the 50s and 60s in terms of his own perception of his career, especially before people like Mr. McBride and Bogdanovich were, you know, building it to what we now perceive it as, a certain fan base of his. What was it like? How did he view himself in the 50s and 60s in light of the way he was treated in the 40s in Hollywood? And I'd especially like to know what his reaction was when Sight and Sound first named Citizen Kane in 1962 Best Picture. I wonder if he had a reaction to that.
You know, I don't think I can answer those questions because I was just too young at the time to really know. I do know that he, in later life, when he was in his maturity, he really wished that people would stop making such a big deal over Citizen Kane, and that they would pay more attention to the works that he made in Europe, many of which are not screened in this country, unfortunately. And he personally thought Chimes at Midnight, he thought that was his masterpiece. And I am so happy that it's going to be a part of the program here, because it's not often screened. So,
I just saw this morning, Bruce Goldstein, our great programmer, showed me the restoration from Spain, and it's terrific. They haven't done anything wrong. I was worried about restoring this film. I was kind of thinking they should just leave it alone. But there were little bits out of sync and stuff, and it doesn't hurt to put them in sync. And it looks beautiful, and it's just a fantastic film. I agree with Chris and your father that it's his best film.
Well, that's what he thought. I always felt that the battle scene in Chimes at Midnight is one of the most lyrical, poetic scenes I've ever seen on the screen. And then it has the humor of Falstaff, you know, running through the battle. You see, but tonight, when we watch Macbeth tonight, and you see the sequence of the woods moving towards the castle and the men chopping down the trees and so on. It's almost, as I saw that, I almost felt that it's a preview of the later battle scene in Falstaff.
Yeah, and you know, he made three terrific Shakespearean films. Othello was the other one. And, you know, the other day we showed Wellesiana, a series I'm going to do tomorrow again, a program of odds and ends, and we showed part of his Voodoo Macbeth, or Black Macbeth, which was a very exciting production and had kind of the same set. He kept using the same set design for Macbeth. He did it on the stage in Salt Lake City. Were you in that production, too?
No, I wasn't in that production. I mean, originally, the original Voodoo Macbeth was done in Harlem with an all-black cast, and my mother took credit for the idea of setting it in Haiti.
Right.
She was very proud that was her contribution to the production.
That was a great revelation in your book. And
of having the three witches that we saw in the film tonight, we had voodoo drummers.
Yeah.
They became the witches.
Charlie Lederer.
This was my mother's idea, and she was very proud of that.
Yeah, she deserves a lot of credit for a lot of his early things. And you know, you said something to me that I found very fascinating. And your father echoed it in a speech we heard, that she advised him not to go into movies but to stay in the theater. And he later in life said, maybe I should have stayed in the theater, and I would have had an easier life, because it's less expensive to put on plays, or it was then anyway. I don't know.
Well, many people at that time who were associated with the Mercury Theater wished that he had stayed in the theater. But if he'd done that, we never would have had the movies,
right.
You know. And theater is very evanescent. We don't really know. We don't have any. We have stills of some of the productions, but we can't really experience what those were like, whereas we can endlessly see the films. I also think that my father used things up, you know. I mean, he went as far as he could go in radio, and then he did as much as he could do in theater. Mm-hmm. And then it's almost as though he had to have a new canvas.
Yeah,
and
he had
movies
so many
were his new canvas.
Yeah, and then he had other things. He did writing, and he did speaking, and
right.
he did recordings. He did so many different things.
I think he just had to go. I mean, we're going to see Too Much Johnson as
right,
part of this
right.
festival. Yeah. And he was still very involved in the theater at that point, but he wanted to incorporate film footage mm-hmm. in the... It was as though he was trying to marry... Right. film and the theater. I almost see that as the beginning of his leap into movies, you know?
Right, and you can see for the first time ever, a facsimile of what it might have been like, because Bruce is going to have 10 actors doing the dialogue and doing some of the farcical things while the
That's
film footage
is so fantastic.
Interspersed.
I can't wait to see that.
Yeah.
I'm going to actually see my mother on the screen when she was, you know, like, 6 months after I was born.
Wow.
That's
yeah.
going to have great personal meaning to me.
I'm glad you're seeing that.
But we should take some questions.
Yeah, more questions.
I'm sure people
sure.
have questions.
Who's got one? Is there a hand over here? Yeah.
Just a quick question about the script. Obviously, Shakespeare. Were there any lines added that are non-Shakespearean? And how much was cut? Details like that?
Well, I'm sure that Joe could answer much more specifically than I can. I can just say in a general way that my father's idea was that when you put a play on the screen, you're working in a different medium. It becomes a movie. So he had no compunction about making whatever changes he thought were necessary for dramatic effect. Like the character of the what should we call him, the priest, he's a completely invented character. I mean, he doesn't exist in the original play at all. And I believe he cut scenes, he moved things around, he did whatever he thought would work dramatically on the. And his big criticism of Laurence Olivier was that he felt that in Olivier's Shakespearean films, he literally translated onto film what he would have done on the stage, whereas my father felt you had to create a new work when you put it on the screen.
Could you tell that wonderful story from your book about what Laurence Olivier told you about your father? I found that very moving.
Yes, I one of the greatest days of my childhood was when I was visiting with my father in London, and we were invited to have lunch with Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh in their country house with all these other people. And I was the only child there. I guess I was about 12 years old at the time, sitting with all these adults, feeling very privileged to be sitting with all these adults. And they had me sitting next to Larry Olivier at the head of the table. And at that time, I guess this would have been in the 50s, right?
Probably around 52,
something like that,
yeah,
early 50s. At that time, my father had fallen into disfavor because he was wandering around Europe hat in hand, wanting people to invest in his movies, and he wasn't having any big successes at the time. And I remember at the table, at one point, Larry said to me, "You know, people don't appreciate your father now. They're making a big fuss over me because I think he had just done his film, you know, the Henry film."
Well, I think it was...
Which one?
He did Henry V during the war.
And that was tremendously...
Hamlet and
these films were huge box office successes. So he said, you know, my films are huge successes with the public. He said, but you know... It's your father's work. Those are the films for the ages. Those, I mean, he recognized his talent, at a time when nobody else seemed to. And I was very touched by that.
That's just so great. Yeah, and he was humble enough to admit that. Yeah, yeah, right here.
Just have a question about how much leeway did he give his cinematographers, or just did it depend on the cinematographer, or were they just sort of a kind of a medium through which his visual, through which his vision moved, or to your knowledge?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you do.
Well, I'll just say one thing. I want to pay tribute again to John Russell. Nobody ever talks about John Russell. He photographed this film, and he did a fabulous job. He was Russell Meddy's operator on The Stranger, and he's the greatest unsung cameraman in Hollywood history, in my opinion. He shot Moonrise for Frank Borzage the same year as this. He later shot Psycho. He did a lot of television, and I guess that's why he's not known as well, because television cinematographers never get mentioned, but he did a lot of the Hitchcock series. And he was the boom operator on Touch of Evil. Wells called him back. He trusted him a lot, and there's a great four-minute tracking moving camera shot in The Stranger. So Russell, I think, deserves a lot of credit for, the director. I was at a taping Wells did of a television program that he was going to do a talk show, and he did the pilot. And he did a big tribute to his crew, and it was very, mm-hmm. very moving. And I wrote it down, quoted it in my book, and he said basically the director can have dreams and visions, but the crew has to carry it out. And he wrote a speech like that on the other side of the wind. He said you can dream anything you want, but these people have to execute your vision.
And, well, don't you think Greg Toland was also very...
Yeah, he was probably maybe the greatest cameraman of all time.
And, of course, he was also the first one, in a way, who worked with my father. And I know my father had enormous respect for him.
Yeah, he said two cameramen asked to work for him. Greg Toland came to see him, the greatest cameraman in the business, said, I want to work for you. And Wells said, why? And he said, well, I want to work for somebody who doesn't know anything. But actually, he had seen Julius Caesar and was impressed by the lighting. Your father kind of did his own lighting on the stage with help, but, and in the first part of Citizen Kane, he was doing his own lighting, not knowing that that was Toland's job. And Toland was nice enough not to say anything. But we worked with a lot of fine cameramen. But there is a style, of course, that is always Wells. And so Gary Graver, modestly, his cameraman at the end of his life, said it was all Orson. And I think Gary was being too modest. But, he was executing Orson's wishes, he said.
Yeah.
So that's, there's a lot of truth to that. He had a tremendous visual sense, so that's probably the answer. Do you remember multiple cameras being used in this film?
You mean in Macbeth?
Macbeth, yeah.
Well, I remember what impressed me as a child, and, in a way I wish I'd been older, because I was only a kid. But what impressed me was that there were all these sets that had been set up. There was work going on simultaneously, because that was the only way to make a movie in 21 days.
Yeah.
And somehow... my father, he would be acting in one thing, and yet his eye, he would be seeing everything that was going on the whole soundstage.
Did they have, you mentioned in your book, too, that they had like three scenes going on at once.
That's right.
So he'd have three cameras, and he would run between cameras?
Well, he would just somehow, he would look around and he'd say, stop, and he would see something that was wrong on another set. And that amazed me that he could do that.
He kept it all in his amazing brain.
Yeah.
Also, the continuity, I was there when he fired the continuity girl on the other side of the wind and told her never to speak to him again. and he kept it in his head. It's amazing. And with a studio film, you have a lot of help, but this film was amazing because I've seen pictures of the shooting where they had some of the soldiers carried little handheld cameras, and they had a mask on their face, on their back of their head as they were shooting. I mean, he did these tricks because he had to shoot so fast.
Tricks. Yeah. He had to work so quickly. Yeah. And I remember the other thing that impressed me so much as a kid. Remember the scene where Banquo, the ghost, appears, and there's the banquet scene? Well, my father wanted to use real food, and everything had to be real, nothing artificial. So they set up this huge banquet table, and then you'll remember at the end of the scene, he upturns the table, and everything goes flying in all directions. Well, of course, I don't know how many takes they did, but they did a lot of takes, and for every single one, they had to reassemble everything, put it all back on the table, and he had to go through it again. And I thought, how does he have the strength?
It's amazing.
How did he have the strength? Of course, I realized when I saw the film tonight, he was very young. At that, you know?
Young and strong.
Well, he was young.
You rode with him in the car every morning. You said that he was preoccupied, of course. Did he feel, you know, directing a film is very hard work, if you're acting in the film, that's tough. Did he seem tired at all or not?
He just exuded almost superhuman energy and enthusiasm, but I think he was, had to be preoccupied. I mean, he had to make that film in 21 days, and, you know.
How do you do that? That's an astonishing feat they should have given him credit for instead of making fun of him for it, which is what they did, you know.
And he was working under such horrendous conditions. I mean, they gave him these crummy sets. You can see that the sets are made of cardboard. I mean, you know. And yet somehow, even working, what impresses me about Macbeth is that he had so little to work with.
And he did so much.
And
with
look,
it.
He did so much with so little.
Tremendous visual things. And you said he was very calm, too, despite the pressure that would have been too much for almost anybody, huh?
He was.
It's amazing. My feeling reading your book and watching him is that he thrived on that kind of pressure.
He did.
He loved working so much, right?
I think he was never happier than when he was actually making a movie. I mean, that's really, he was at his best when he was making films, you know. He loved it. You could just tell it was a kind of joyous thing with him.
Yeah, and that kind of overrode all the problems he might have had. So who else has a question? There's somebody over here, I think.
Hey.
Oh, right here. Okay.
And I'm back here, actually.
They had to get... Wells was in Europe, and he recorded... he actually flew back to Hollywood, made a secret visit so the witch hunters didn't know he was in the country, and did some re-recording. But he also did some re-recording in London, and they shipped his tracks back. And then they brought in Jeanette Nolan to re-record. Her performance suffered the most, I thought, because I didn't think she was very good in the first version, which we're showing, by the way, the American version on January 25th for comparison. But her performance, I think, is terrific. And it really gains a lot from her Scottish accent. She was a radio actress.
She was a radio actress. I think this was her film debut. This is like the first film she'd ever been in. It's the first time she'd ever appeared as an actress and not just a voice.
Her voice is terrific.
She was quite impressive, I thought.
So she you know, was in Hollywood and redubbed it, and other people, Roddy McDowall is in it, the young guy,
Roddy McDowall is Malcolm.
Malcolm, the king. Yeah, the new king.
And, you know, he was only 19 or something at the time.
Did you get to know him very well?
Yeah, and this was his first Shakespearean film, so I think he did very well.
Yeah, he was fine. He was terrific and such a good young actor he was.
Yes, I'm back here.
Yeah.
Hey. Okay. Very simple fanboy question. I know you talked about the horses and your joy in working with them. Was that you on the horse galloping away? And tell me about your horsemanship and your father's horsemanship.
No, that was my playmate. That was...
oh, Jerry.
Sorry about that.
That was Jerry. No, he was the other little boy. No, he was... I thought he was very cute in the film, actually.
Yeah. Manny Farber's nephew, the critic Manny Farber, he mentioned that in his review. My nephew Jerry was very good in the film, he said.
Yeah.
could you tell us about the murder scene? Because you described that in detail. That was a shocking... scene, and it's tough to watch.
Well, yes. Well, what I had to do was I had to run like hell down this hallway with the assassin chasing me, and then fall on a mattress, which you don't really see the mattress. You just see me going down. So we did it the first time, and my father said, "No, no, no." And I thought, oh, my God, I did something wrong. I thought I'd done it. No, but it wasn't me he was yelling at. It was the assassin. He said, "You have to hit her harder. Come on, you're not hitting her harder." I thought, oh, my God, this is my father talking to me. He said, and I'll never forget, he said, you look like Margaret O'Brien touching a hot stove. Come on. I want you to really hit her. Hit her. I thought, oh, my God. So the man said, but I don't want to hurt your kid. Forget she's my kid. Just be an assassin. Well, this was another reason I decided not to pursue a career.
He was using a rubber knife, I think, right?
Yeah, but it was just the idea that he wanted him to, you know, really give it to me. You know?
That bothered you.
Yeah, it bothered me.
Yeah, yes. I can understand. Yes. Yeah, right there. Okay. And then,
thank you. Your father appears as a character in the movie Ed Woods. I wondered how you felt watching that.
Well, I haven't seen that movie.
Oh, you should. It's a terrific scene. He talks to him about Citizen Kane, Ed Wood being a horrible director. It's a wonderful movie, and that's a great scene.
Actually, Ed Wood, I have to defend him. Everybody says he's the world's worst director, but I think he's a good personal filmmaker. I think Glenn or Glenda is a real personal film. And so there's a reason they put them together in that film is they're both personal filmmakers working against the system, you know. And, but anyway, let's have another question here.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could just speak a little more on how he was on set and how he juggled acting and directing. And did he have anyone working with him as an actor or,
Well, I think I've pretty much shared with you already that what impressed me was his tremendous energy, his kind of joyous enjoyment of everything that was going on, and the fact that he was so on top of everything that was going on and was so aware. And the set, I mean, I just remember the set was pandemonium. I mean, it was like they were rushing from one set up to the next, dragging all this heavy equipment around, and you had to really keep your eyes peeled not to get knocked into or not sent flying. So it was very hard working conditions, and yet somehow he triumphed over all of that, and that impressed me a lot, actually.
Well, the scene where you had a lot of dialogue, did he give you line readings and tell you how to read each line and everything? Do you remember?
I remember that we did, we did a sort of a run through before we actually filmed it. Mm-hmm. But I had memorized my lines.
Oh, okay.
You know,
well,
I mean, I didn't understand it all, but I memorized it.
You talk about a rehearsal at your father's house too. That you were
well.
At.
That was a read through. That was reading through. But you know, he'd already done this production on the stage before he decided to film it
with most of the same actors.
With most of the same actors, so the cast was pretty familiar with.
Which is smart because it helps them shoot fast because they knew their lines.
Yeah, right.
Who else has in the back there, that fellow there. Yeah.
Well, I just asked you, when you told your father you wanted to participate in the play, did he have faith in you, or was he sort of like iffy?
In a play?
In the play, the film, you mean?
Oh, in the film.
Yeah.
Well, you know, my father really didn't encourage me. He didn't really want me to be in the movies, and I now thank him very much for that. but he just felt, he felt from what he knew of me that it wouldn't be the right life for me. And I think he turned out to be right about that. So even though as a kid I thought this is what I should be doing and I was pestering him all the time, I think in the end he was right to discourage me.
Could you tell us about your career? You chose writing the Brain Quest series and things and writing this book, and you turned into a writer. How did that happen?
I turned out to be a writer, which really suits me much better than it would have been to be an actress. And I spent most of my adult life writing materials for children, educational materials, you know, for the elementary grades, textbooks and other things like that. And then in the early 90s, I was approached by one of my publishers to do an educational game for children, Brain Quest. I don't know if you know it, but
very popular.
But that was my biggest success. It was also the most fun.
I was just talking to an editor at Workman Publishing, which published that, and she was bragging about what a big success that series was. Oh, Chris! Well, oh, she did. Chris Fetter did that series. So you've had a wonderful career. What finally motivated you to start talking about your father? For a long time, you were kind of in the shadows, as you say in your book, and you didn't want to talk publicly, or am I wrong about that?
Yes, well, I really liked the idea of living a private life, and I didn't really want to also, while my father was alive, you know, all of us were sworn to secrecy. I mean, he never really wanted us to give interviews or anything like that. And so I respected that while my father was alive. But then after his death, there were all these tributes. And then I would be invited to do this and to do that. And so I guess little by little, I came out of the closet, you know.
Coaxed you out because we wanted to hear your take, and it's been very illuminating. And are you coming to more of the Wells tributes this year?
Well, of course I'm coming to this one because you're my friend, and I was very happy to participate. I've been invited to there's going to be a big homage in Barcelona, and I love Barcelona. I'm mainly going because I love Barcelona.
I'll see you there. That'll be a wonderful international conference. Yeah. That's Chimes of Midnight is part of that. We're going to see it in the cathedral where they filmed it.
Yes.
Well, let's take maybe two more questions because we're running short on time, but who hasn't asked a question yet?
I have the microphone over here, and I have a question. I grew up actually watching your father in film because my grandfather was a very big fan. So my experience, of course, of Wells is very different than, of course, than yours. And I saw that power in his characters and his performances. When were you first conscious of his power as a performer? Because, of course, you saw him as dad, as maybe, you know, serving you scrambled eggs or telling you to brush your teeth. But when did you get an idea of his power as a performer in theater?
I think it was in movies. I think when I began to see my father's films when I was in my late teens, early 20s, that's when I realized his artistry, you know. When I was a kid, I didn't really realize it. I was very impressed. I mean, the first time I saw my father on stage was when I was about, I think, 5 years old, and he did a magic show for the troops in Los Angeles. And I had never seen him on the stage before, and I was very taken with him. Mm. He was Orson the Magnificent.
Yeah. Did you? He told you that was the thing he was proudest of? Or?
And he felt he did this show. It was for the troops during World War II. They were stationed in Los Angeles, and they were going to be shipped out to the Pacific. And so the show was free for the soldiers, but other people had to pay through the nose to get in there. But he said he was the proudest of that, of anything he ever did, because it was a wonderful magic show, and it introduced. Rita Hayworth was there for one night, and she was sawed in half, you know. And
tomorrow we're showing, as we should, again, Follow the Boys is part of my Wellsiana program at 2:45. It's a five-minute recreation on film that he did of that wonderful act.
With Marlene
with
Dietrich.
Dietrich. And he directed that sequence, and it is wonderful, and he loved magic. Well, let's take one more question, maybe. Somebody who hasn't had one, fella here. Yeah.
What is it like now, so many years after this film, and of course after your father's passing, to see him on the big screen?
Well, I think at this point in my life, I can look at it much more objectively. And I really got a tremendous amount out of seeing Macbeth tonight. I feel like I never quite appreciated it as deeply as I did tonight. Both his performance as Macbeth and his artistry as a director. And just the way, the whole very original and impressionistic way he created this film, it really... I thought it was terrific.
It was a wonderful movie.
I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I did.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, and we can't thank you enough for coming, and it's so enjoyable to talk to you. And everybody, read Chris's book and My Father's Shadow, wonderful book. Thank you so much, Chris.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm so happy to be here, Joe.
Great to be here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.